This is Eco Radio KC, a locally produced exploration of positive solutions to the ecological challenges we face as we work to create a healthier future for our community and the planet.
Good evening, and thank you for tuning into Eco Radio. On tonight's program, we welcome Dr. Eric Mueliger from UC Davis to discuss his research on the connection between air pollution and violent crime. But first, I'm Natural E with your headline news. Colorlines.com reports, crude oil could begin flowing through the Dakota Access Pipeline as early as today. This comes after a federal appeals court refused a request on Saturday, March 18th, by the Standing Rock Sioux and Cheyenne River Sioux tribes to issue an emergency order to keep oil from flowing through the 1,172-mile-long pipeline from North Dakota to Illinois, reports the Associated Press. Color Lines reached out to developer Energy Transfer Partners for comment but did not receive an answer by publication. This decision does not impact the case Standing Rock Sioux Tribe v. U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, which the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe launched against the Army Corps of Engineers last July. That case's court date is tentatively expected for April, says Earth Justice Senior Press Secretary Philip Ellis. The EPA awarded the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality a $100 million grant on March 17th to help the state restructure the water system in the city of Flint, where a crisis continues to keep residents from using their tap water. Flint Mayor Karen Weaver expressed gratitude about Pruitt's statement. The funds will help the city replace its outdated water pipes, which are where the lead continues to leach into the water supply. Quote, "These funds will give us what we need to reach our goal of replacing 6,000 pipes this year and make other needed infrastructure improvements," end quote, Weaver said. This money comes from the Water Infrastructure Improvements for the Nation Act of 2016, which former President Barack Obama signed last year in December. The EPA notes on its website that this act supplements the agency's Drinking Water State Revolving Fund, which remains fully funded under President Donald Trump's proposed budget, which was released March 16th. TheGuardian.com reports carbon dioxide emissions from energy have not increased for 3 years in a row, even as the global economy grew, the International Energy Agency said. Global emissions from the energy sector were 32.1 billion tons in 2016, the same as the previous 2 years, while the economy grew 3.1%, the organization said. The IEA put the halt in growth down to growing renewable power generation, switches from coal to natural gas, and improvements in energy efficiency, but say it is too soon to say that global emissions have peaked. The biggest drop was seen in the U.S., where carbon dioxide emissions fell 3%, while the economy grew 1.6%, following a surge in shale gas supplies and more renewable power that displaced coal. U.S. emissions are at their lowest level since 1992, while the economy has grown 80% since that time. The U.K. saw a significant coal-to-gas switch in the power sector in the face of cheaper gas and a carbon price floor, which makes polluting coal a more expensive source of energy, the IEA said. The pause in emissions growth was welcomed by the IEA, but it warned it was not enough to meet globally agreed targets to limit temperature rises to below 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels, considered to be the threshold for dangerous climate change. And at this time, we're ready to welcome in our guest. And our guest is Dr. Eric Mueliger. He's the Assistant Professor of Economics and the Chair of the Graduate Program at the University of California, Davis, and a faculty research fellow of the National Bureau of Economics Research. We'll be speaking with him this evening about his co-authored paper, Air Pollution and Criminal Activity, Evidence from Chicago Microdata. How are you this evening, Dr. Mueliger?
I'm good. Thanks for having me on.
Excellent. We are so glad you could join us. I also have my co-host, Mr. Richard Mabian. And go ahead and say hi to the people, Richard.
Yeah, how are you doing? This is Richard Mabian. It's very nice to meet you, sir.
Nice to meet you, too.
All right, Dr. Mueliger. So we're here to talk about you wrote in your abstract that this was the first quasi-experimental evidence that air pollution causally affects criminal activity. So is this a first paper or first study of its kind?
It is. I mean, it's the first one that we know about. So there is a long literature that looks at the the impacts that air pollution has on people's health, on things like people's productivity, and also on educational attainment, often looking at student test scores. What this paper looks at is it looks at another type of behavior that we care a lot about and looks to see how air pollution affects people's commission of crime, and in particular, violent crime.
Right. I read that, like you said, a lot of the test, the information out there about how air pollution affects us was mostly around like test scores and thinking and things like that, but not really the crime aspect. And also, you made sure to point out that it wasn't just all crime, it was violent crime, right, Dr. Mueliger?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So what we find in the paper is we basically find that when people are exposed to air pollution, we see an increase in the amount of violent crime that occurs in a particular area where the air pollution is being blown towards. But now, we don't see a similar effect on property crimes.
On property crimes. So what constitutes violent crime?
So violent crimes are defined by the Federal Bureau of Investigation. The Federal Bureau of Investigation basically has a way of ranking a whole bunch of crimes into different groups. What we talk about when we talk about violent crime, we're mainly talking about the vast majority of violent crimes are assaults and batteries. Rape and murder also are in sort of the category of violent crime, but are much less frequent than the first two.
Now, I have to ask, why did you choose this topic to explore?
Well, we actually got interested in this topic because we felt like the literature on pollution and outcomes, while it did a very good job at understanding the effects on things like health or on things like educational attainment, we felt like it was missing sort of the broader question about how air pollution might affect behavior in much more broad ways than were previously being investigated. In addition, there's actually a literature that goes back a ways in psychology and a growing literature in medicine that basically documents that things like air pollution might affect people in much more complicated ways than would simply be measured by someone's test scores or emergency visits for respiratory illness or things like that.
So
one of the parts of this literature, especially sort of this literature from psychology, often finds that when you put people in situations in which they're physically uncomfortable, often they act more aggressively, they're less cooperative. And so one of the things that sort of naturally came to mind when we were thinking about this was we wanted to sort of see whether or not outside of the sort of psychology lab environment, whether we would see effects in sort of the real world. When people were exposed to air pollution, did they start to behave more aggressively or did they start to, act more impulsively?
Yes, I thought that was very interesting that you all, in the article, you talked about some few studies where people, scientists brought subjects into the lab and then they exposed them to harmful pollutants, and that's rare because of the ethics involved with that. I just thought that was kind of interesting how you all took a real world way to gather this information, and you looked at how the wind blew the pollutants from I-290, was it? Will you explain to our audience?
Yeah, absolutely. So, in the sort of laboratory environment, it's often very difficult to do this kind of work because we don't want to expose people to harmful pollutants or sort of things like that. But there are actually a lot of environments in the real world that basically provide us the same kind of laboratory sort of environment. What we look at in this paper is we look at the city of Chicago. And if your listeners are familiar with the city of Chicago, there are a bunch of interstates that basically run in and out of the city. So in particular, you mentioned I-290. That's a big interstate that basically runs straight east-west out of downtown Chicago. And what we essentially did was we looked at the areas right around these interstates. Now, on some days, the wind will be blowing in a particular direction where the pollution from that interstate is being blown to one side of the interstate. And on a different day, the wind will be blowing in the opposite direction. So the pollution from that particular interstate will be blown onto the other side of the interstate. And so essentially the exercise we do in the paper is we look to see whether crime is higher on the downwind side of the interstate on a particular day relative to the side of the interstate which is upwind. What we find in the paper is basically the downwind side of the interstate experiences about a 2% increase in the amount of violent crime that occurs relative to the upwind side of the interstate, the side that's, you know, where the wind is blowing from. Now, although the impact is not terrifically large in magnitude, it's a 2% increase, so we're talking about, you know, fractions of a violent crime. We think that this paper actually suggests that the effects of air pollution might be, you know, much more complicated and much more important than were previously considered in previous work.
Okay, what brings you to that conclusion with such a low number?
Well, I think, you know, although we're really focused on, you know, violent crime in this particular case, mm-hmm. what it suggests is that air pollution doesn't just affect health, it doesn't just affect test scores, but it's affecting people's behavior in much more complicated ways.
Right.
And so, you know, we're looking in particular at violent crime here because it's something which is easily tracked and easily measurable. But if air pollution has other impacts on people's decision-making or people's behaviors, you could imagine that, you know, exposure to air pollution might have much more important impacts that we just aren't able to measure as easily because we don't have, you know, something nice and convenient like a test score or something nice and convenient like, you know, a violent crime report to a police department.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Dr. Eric Mueliger. He's the Associate Professor of Economics and the Chair of the Graduate Program at the University of California, Davis. And he's speaking about his co-authored paper, Air Pollution and Criminal Activity, Evidence from Chicago Microdata. Now, you gathered this information over 12 years. You looked at 12 years of data that was collected?
Yeah, that's right. So we have a data set which basically reports... it's a data set that's publicly available, in fact. The city of Chicago provides a tremendous amount of publicly available data, but this is a data set which stretches from 2001 to 2012, and the data set has every single crime which was reported to the Chicago Police Department over that period.
I was going to ask about the cost implications. With this 2.2% increase of the violent crime due to air pollution, what does that mean as far as the costs to the city of Chicago?
Well, yeah, no, that's a great question. I mean, I think there are, you know, there's a lot of work which is done which tries to quantify the cost of crime. And it's a very sort of, you know, it's a very sort of tough thing to do because you're trying to put a dollar value on, you know, something like an assault or right. things like that. In dollar terms, you know, what we're finding here is we're really looking at a very sort of narrow area of the city of Chicago. I mean, we're really only looking at these areas that run in and out of the city center. But we find that, you know, if there is an increase in the amount of violent crime which is occurring, violent crimes are very costly. I mean, they impose a lot of costs, both in terms of the amount of money people spend sort of to engage in preventative measures, the amount of money which is spent on policing, but also just the, you know, the monetary, the sort of the physical costs of violent crime, you know, are very, very costly to individuals.
Dr. Mueliger, I wanted to ask, do we have a caller, Mike? Okay, it seems that we have a caller. Caller, will you please tell us your first name and what part of the city you're calling from?
Kansas City, Kansas, and my name is Anthony.
Hi, Anthony.
Hi. My question is, has anyone done any studies on China and their pollution problem and their violent crimes and murders and things like that that's, you say that's going on in California and Texas and, you know, other states that has a lot of pollution? What about China? And they have a very bad pollution problem over there where people wear masks on a daily basis. So is their crime rate actually higher than it should be or per capita or what? You know, I don't know.
That's a great question. Go ahead, Dr. Miller.
Yeah, I think this is a fantastic question. I mean, this is actually something that we're really interested in trying to understand. I mean, I think there are a lot of places around the world where pollution is much worse than the pollution we experience in the United States. I'm not aware of anyone who has started to take a look at that. I mean, I think one of the nice things about the context that we look at in the city of Chicago is we have really good information about where these crimes are happening and when these crimes are happening. And so with that detail, we can really look at this nice comparison of, you know, what happens on the downwind side of an interstate when the wind's blowing that direction versus that exact same side of the interstate on a day where the wind is blowing the opposite direction and blowing the pollution away. But I think your point is a great one. I mean, if we're finding effects in the context of the city of Chicago and the types of levels of pollution that we experience here, we might expect that the effects might be magnified if we thought about a situation in which there's much higher levels of pollution.
And so that can also speak for the reason of the rise in police brutalities and violence from police officers and things like that is due to the pollution could have something to do with that then, right?
I think there's certainly a possibility there. I mean, I think, you know, it's a little bit difficult for us to pin down the exact mechanism, but, I think part of what, our results are certainly consistent with is that exposure to air pollution seems to increase, people's aggressiveness and sort of reduce the degree to which people are willing to cooperate. And so this would not just apply to potentially, individuals, but might also apply to police as well.
Okay, one more question. Getting this information on public radio, I mean, it's not everyone like myself listens to public radio on a daily basis, especially this time of day, to get this information that you guys let out. The mainstream people need to know this. And is there any kind of way that you can put this on KNBC News or WDAF and, stations like that so they can hear these stats that you guys come up with? Because this is something that's very important, and people need to know about it. Maybe we need to start wearing masks on a daily basis. The violence down.
I'm glad you think it's interesting. I think it's important and interesting as well. Getting it on mainstream media requires mainstream media to also be sort of excited about it. I thank you for your enthusiasm.
Thank you very much, Anthony. All right, Dr. Mueliger. It looks like Richard has a question for you.
Yes, Dr. Sure. Mueliger. I work in the environmental industry, and I'm concerned about, and this is a very interesting article. In fact, I heard about it and brought it into the station. What type of pollution were you looking at? I mean, if we put it on a scale, like we deal with diesel emission here in Kansas City and around different places in the country, and that's one of the pollutions that affects us in our low-income communities, and also from coming from coal fire plants. And we're looking at that 2.5 figure as far as the type of the particles, that people are measuring for the pollution. Did you use any of those in your tests, or what did you use?
Yeah, so essentially what we're finding here is this is just we're finding an effect of being exposed to the whole mix of pollutants that are coming up from cars and trucks that are traveling on these interstates. Okay. So it's very difficult for us to sort of separate out, the effect in our particular case of PM2.5 or of ozone or smog pollution, or sort of the different kinds of pollutants. So really what we're sort of capturing here is, you know, this is sort of the effect of being exposed to the mix of pollutants which are coming out of tailpipes as these cars are traveling, these cars and trucks are traveling along the highway.
You know, I think Anthony's question was outstanding, the one that he asked in reverse to what was happening with your violent crime that's being perpetrated by citizens, when he also mentioned the fact about the police, and also when he brought up the thing about China. I had been thinking previously that it's kind of like the behaviors exist that are susceptible to this explosiveness that can come from the pollution that you have discovered can cause that to happen. One of the things that impressed me with your study was the graph that you had on the ozone layer. You showed that when the ozone, that the violence went up when the ozones were up. Can you explain that to me just a little bit, please?
Yeah, sure. So one of the other exercises we actually do in the paper is, you know, instead of just focusing on these areas right around the interstates, another thing we can do is we can just look to see when the city of Chicago is relatively polluted. So it's when it has relatively high ozone levels, and there are sort of a whole network of pollution monitors that track different kinds of pollutants. But one of the things we can look at is we can look at things like ozone levels, and we can look to see whether crime is higher on days where ozone levels also tend to be high. Now, it's a little tricky because ozone levels being high often happen at the same time that there are other things going on which also are associated with violent crime. So in particular, ozone levels tend to be really high on warm days in the summer. Mm-hmm. And there's a long literature which understands that as temperatures go up, people become less cooperative, they become more aggressive. This is a sort of a well-understood phenomenon in law enforcement, that during summer months you see an increase in the amount of aggressive crime that goes on. And so the way we try to separate out the effect of temperature versus the effect of pollution in this case is we use the fact that just like with the highways in Chicago, when the wind blows from particular directions, air pollution is high in the city of Chicago. And when it blows other directions, it's not high. And so a good example of this is there are a bunch of refineries and foundries and corn milling facilities and things like that that are located on sort of the a little bit south of the city of Chicago. And so when the wind is blowing from sort of the south to the north, air quality in Chicago tends to be less good than when the wind is blowing from other directions. And so essentially what we do is we compare days where they're sort of the same temperature, they're the same time of year, sort of things like that. But on one of those days, the wind is blowing from the south and pollution tends to be pretty high in the city. And then on another day, the wind is blowing from a different direction and pollution tends to be pretty low. And just as we find with the interstates and the downwind side of the interstate, we find that levels of violent crime are elevated on days where the wind is blowing from directions, which is basically blowing pollution into the city of Chicago.
So, and now I'll get it back to Natural Lee here. But so I'm meeting with the chief of police in Kansas City, Kansas, Wednesday morning. And I think this is a very good study that he should be made aware of. I agree with the caller that called in and said that he thought that we should be doing that publicly, and I agree with you on that too. So I'm wondering, do you think it would be, because we can't put a solution to this, there's just no way you can, there's too much that we don't know, but do you think it would be a benefit if, in fact, they monitored the ozone levels and somewhat spoke to their officers on those particular days about the need for them to be cognizant of the fact that this was going to be a high ozone day? And after explaining what statistics you all have discovered happens in the violent portion of the certain portions of the city when that go on, do you think that would be a benefit for them?
I mean, I think sort of what our paper suggests, and, you know, again, I wouldn't necessarily say, you know, let's start basing, you know, policing policy just on the basis of this one paper. But I think, you know, what this paper suggests is that this is actually, you know, potentially an important consideration. You know, it's there are going to be a lot of other factors which are going to be much larger in magnitude. But again, to the extent that we think that air pollution is having an impact on how people make decisions, you know, what I sort of view this as is, you know, a study which will hopefully encourage other people to start to think carefully about this stuff and, you know, to really try to understand what are the other impacts that air pollution has on individuals' decision-making and things like that.
Dr. Mueliger, I really like what you just said. It kind of makes this this need to keep an environmental perspective here and now, because I know a lot of times, sometimes we can be like, well, it's not going to affect me. I'm not going to be here in 20, 50, you know, 60 years. It's not going to be my world. But you're talking about how pollution and these environmental factors are affecting us right now, today.
Yeah, absolutely right. And I mean, I think this is one of the things that's been, I think, really surprising. I mean, I think we all sort of, you know, probably had a pretty good sense that air pollution was bad for, you know, respiratory health.
Right.
That on really polluted days, you can, you know, if you're in a really polluted area, you can sort of feel that it's hard to breathe and you just don't feel good. But I think a lot of the really interesting research that's been done recently has been highlighting the fact that, you know, these pollutants not only affect our physical health, but potentially have impacts on how we think, our, you know, the ability for us to think, you know, and in the case of my work with my co-authors, you know, potentially influencing, you know, how we behave in very meaningful ways. And so if you think about all the important decisions that we make on a day-to-day basis, even if we think that those decisions are affected just a little bit by mm-hmm. air pollution, we're making a lot of decisions every day, some of which are very important. And so I think it definitely is the type of thing where, you know, we want to understand this better. We really need to understand, you know, how does air pollution affect the decisions we make?
That's right. And we have one more caller. Will you please state your first name and what part of the city you're calling from?
Robert Lindox.
Hi, Robert.
And I was wondering this. Our star gives green light, blue light, red, and orange. And at the most polluted times, that green and blue feel-good light, it's bounced back out in space. I wondered if you think that might add to it, the violence.
Yeah, so explain to me your question. I didn't quite catch it. Sorry.
The lack of the blue and green light from our sun, our star, because of the pollution, feed well lets in is red and orange and filters out the blue and green, which is still good light, isn't it?
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, I haven't really thought about that as being an impact of pollution. You know, the areas that we're looking at are not, you know, the areas in Chicago that we're looking at are places where the levels of pollution aren't so high that I think you're seeing sort of visible impacts of it. But I think your question is an interesting one. I actually don't know.
Thank you very much, Robert. Or Mike, you got something? Thank you very much, Robert. Dr. Mueliger, I wanted to ask about I know Richard already talked about the particles, but in the paper it talked about measuring NO emissions. I don't know what that is.
So NO emissions are nitrous oxide. So these are emissions. A lot of them, you know, are generated by cars and sort of things like that, and they're one of the things which is a precursor to urban air pollution, to smog.
Okay.
And so it's the EPA tracks a whole bunch of different types of pollutants, You know, some of which are things like NO, which is which was something we've cared a lot about in the past because it creates smog and sort of things like that. But a lot of the things we've started to care a lot more about recently have been these things called PM2.5 and PM10, which are these little tiny bits of particulate matter that can get in people's lungs that we think have important health consequences.
And then also they can go straight to our brain as well, right?
That's right, yeah. No, I mean, some of the very small particles, are small enough that they can actually go into your lungs, pass into your bloodstream,
mm-hmm. right.
and then sort of the smallest particle can even sort of pass from your bloodstream into your brain or into other tissues.
I think we have one more caller. Will you please state your first name and where you're calling from?
Jim, Kansas City.
Hi, Jim.
So I just tuned in, and I was going to put on some music, and then I heard the gentleman speaking about the kind of mental health and behavioral consequences of environmental pollutants, and I thought you may be interested to know that the American Psychiatric Association, 37,000-member organization, passed an action paper. It was like a resolution 2 years ago stating that the APA needs to educate its members about the impact of environmental toxins on neural development, particularly because once the fetus, is, affected in a certain way, that can affect them for the rest of their life, and also on behavior in general.
Mm-hmm.
And behavior includes everything from our thoughts and feelings to, our outer, like violence is a clear relationship between lead levels and violent behavior. So I just wanted to make sure that, I guess I would be happy to, be available. I can give you my information later, but maybe the speaker has some thoughts on that. And the action has kind of stalled because one of the councils that it went to last year didn't really know enough about it. In the APA, the American Psychiatric, didn't know enough about it, and they kind of wanted me to rewrite the resolution, and I said, no. It already passed the governance body, pass it to somebody else. So we're working on developing a committee of experts, and I've been in contact with a researcher from the MIND Institute, which is a institute at University of California, who's internationally mm-hmm. known, and I think it's really going to be, this is going to become very prominent, the mental health aspects of pollution. Just thought I'd mention that.
Thank you very much.
Hey, caller.
Yeah, that's a great comment.
Real quick, Professor. Caller, if you do have more information to give us, perhaps you could call back as soon as professor gets off the air. Okay, thanks.
Sure.
Yeah, no, I think your comment is spot on. I mean, I think that, in this particular paper, we're focused on sort of a very particular type of connection between pollution and criminal activity. And really what we're focused on in this paper is sort of a very short run. There's sort of short run exposure and we see a short run uptick in criminal activity. But, I think what you suggest is I think there are very sort of important issues. When we start to think about environmental pollutants, whether they're in the air, the water, or whatever, both with respect to, what happens when individuals are exposed to those over a long period of time and how that might manifest over sort of, not just, one day, but over months or years, but also, how exposure at particular, formative periods of one's life might be really important. And there's I think, a lot of really compelling evidence that, babies who are exposed in utero to pollution end up being less healthy and are more likely to, have low birth weight it's associated with all sorts of, all sorts of consequences. And, again, I mean, I think this is one of the reasons why there really needs to be more research in this area because, you know, I think the impacts of pollution on people's health, on people's cognition, is a really complicated one. And you know, some of the effects are very short-run effects, like the ones, you know, I look at in this paper. But we might think that these sort of short-run effects might actually be, you know, less important than some of these really long-lived ones that might, you know, not only last for a very long period of time, but, you know, might be something where, you know, exposure at a very young age has an impact over someone's entire life.
Dr. Mielecker, how are we doing on time? How are you doing on time?
I've got 5 more minutes, so I'm happy to stay on and answer more questions if people have them.
Okay, let's go.
I have one more for you, sir, and I'm very onto this thing about the violence that goes on between the police and the people that live in the neighborhoods and the possibilities that that could be something involving from the pollution that they're receiving. I'm just sitting here just stunned at the fact that that even exists. Do you have any suggestions of what we could possibly do to explore that even more?
Well, I mean, I think sort of the first step of trying to understand anything is collecting good data and things like that. I mean, I think, you know, I like violent crime. I mean, I think there are going to be a lot of factors which are very important in you know, sort of influencing both violent crime, but also, you know, influencing sort of how the police, you know, interact with the community. You know, and so, you know, I think the first step for understanding any of that is to you know, make sure we're collecting data that we can use to try to understand those relationships.
I just wanted to ask one more on behalf of that caller that called in first, Anthony. He wanted to ask Dr. Mielecker if there are any sort of tests or information about chemicals in our, like, household hazardous chemicals, and how that affects our behavior.
I think that's a great question. I'm not aware of anything that looks at specific chemicals and sort of human behavior. I'm sure there's probably a lot of work that's done, you know, in sort of the medical literature and things like that, thinking mm-hmm. about, you know, how particular pollutants might manifest in, you know, in laboratory environment in the context of you know, mice and rats and sort of things like that. And we discuss a little bit of that in our paper, sort of that literature. You know, I mean, to be frank, there are a lot of different pollutants out there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think it's, you know, there's some, I guess, for which, you know, there's a very well understood link. So the previous caller talked a little bit about lead, and there's a long literature documenting, you know, how lead can have negative impacts on cognitive development and can have behavioral impacts further on in life. And this is sort of a well-understood relationship. You know, I think there are going to be a lot of other chemicals out there which, you know, we potentially don't know as much about, you know, and whether they have impacts on our health or our behavior is you know, something that, you know, I think we should work to understand.
Dr. Mielecker, in your conclusion of the paper, you said, quote, "Our results suggest that the external costs of pollution may be greater than previously estimated, implying optimal policy should more stringently regulate air pollution." And that I end quote. And we feel that way too, Dr. Mielecker. We really appreciate your work on this subject, and we really, really appreciate you calling in and sharing this information with us and taking all of our questions.
Well, thank you for having me on the show. It's been really enjoyable.
Excellent.
Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
And we're going to go to World Ocean Radio right after these messages.
The image of the wanderer, the traveler without a home, it's a universal figure woven throughout all the world's major holy books.
All of us wander this world as strangers in some way or another.
Build that wall! Build that wall!
As the courts and the White House wrangle over immigration policy, we air a special episode about welcoming the stranger.
For good people say to the foreigner, there is enough food for you.
That's next time on Interfaith Voices.
Tuesday at noon.
On the next Radioactive Magazine, how in the world did a candidate as outrageous as Donald J. Trump attract enough working class votes to become president? Or renowned author, radio commentator, college professor, and radical economist Richard Wolff will provide his answer on the next Radioactive Magazine. And yes, this is the same Richard Wolff who will be featured at the KKFI fundraising dinner, meet and greet, and book signing on March the 24th. That's Radioactive Magazine, Tuesday at 6 p.m., and the Richard Wolff fundraiser. Details at kkfi.org.
Welcome to World Ocean Radio. I'm Peter Neal, director of the World Ocean Observatory. Our mission is to advocate for the ocean through information and educational service, and we do so in myriad ways to include these radio features, aggregated video, a digital magazine, a virtual aquarium, a monthly newsletter, online exhibits, a sharing space for classrooms, a forum for the best new voices with the best new ideas for ocean solutions, and relentless social media. The idea is to demonstrate the vast connection of the sea to every aspect of human endeavor, how the ocean nurtures us and will provide for our future, if we will let it. This requires constant and varied activity, lots of bits and pieces taken together, content as wide, deep, and dynamic as the ocean itself. Sometimes the subject seems so vast and varied that no amount of activity can do it justice, and, as we see the constantly shifting shape of indifference, frustration abounds. Sometimes, then, it seems useful to review the challenges, the astonishing number of challenges, to the integrity and sustainability of this profound natural resource. Sometimes it serves to hear the names of our enemies read aloud. Acid, carbon dioxide, toxic emissions, methane, oil, chemicals, organic pollutants, antibiotics, plastics, invasive species, radioactivity, mining, urban detritus, household garbage, construction debris, overfishing, illegal fishing, abandoned fishing gear, impact of coastal development, war, to name just a few, in no particular order of impact or evil. How does one even understand the full implication of all this aggressive, destructive negativity aligned against a natural resource that is now clearly proving vulnerable to such assault, limiting its ability to dilute and absorb such behavior, indeed to maintain its resilience and capacity for renewal? We have done our worst to despoil the land. Are we really prepared to destroy the global ocean and all its potential for sustaining us into the future? Most days, I leap to engage those enemies as best I can with the tools and resources available. Success can be measured and is always inspiring. The sharing and connecting, the responding and engaging that can be counted and interpreted as progress. And welcome their posting of our observations on to more family and friends, to new citizens of the ocean. But today, here in Downeast Maine, there is a northeaster storm in train. Our small world shut out by white, the bay absented from sight by a wild weave of horizontal snow. Strangely, it seems less frenetic than the usual pace, and the calm permits reflection. The quiet enables a return to the ideas and intentions that generated our commitment to the ocean some 15 years ago. Forgive me this instance of public introspection when I ask myself, have we gotten anywhere at all? Can the ocean feel? Certainly the ocean can show emotion, calm, anger. And on a day like today, as the contrast of snow and light makes it roiled, dark, and brooding, a contained sorrow, as if just now it knows the seriousness of the sickness within. Most all of us have known a friend or family member with sickness suddenly revealed, and understand to some degree the pain, the fear, and the determination of those who insist to survive. I lost a friend recently to a fast, debilitating disease, watched her fight back with fearsome Yankee determination, and yet, at some critical point along the way, saw her lose hold and fail. It still seems unfathomable to me that she is no longer vital and capable to provide such friendship and goodness. But what can sorrow teach us? That we might lose the ocean. We could, part by part, a coastal area devoid of oxygen, a reef destroyed by acidification, a fish species taken beyond regeneration by overharvest and consumption. We have evidence of such things in some number already. But this is real. Our fresh water, food, energy, health, and security in the future will depend on a healthy ocean. Thus, we cannot despair lest we lose hold. succumb to our indifference and irresponsibility and abandon our most important system for sustenance and survival. What can sorrow teach us? That there is no time for sorrow. When the weather clears, we must look forward to see what we have, what we need, what we treasure, out there in that expanse of water and light. The mission waits. The sea connects all things. We will discuss these issues and more in future editions of World Ocean Radio.
World Ocean Radio is produced by the World Ocean Observatory in association with WERU-FM, Blue Hill, Maine. Find our podcast on iTunes and at worldoceanobservatory.org.
Pack your bathing suit and your hiking boots for this current cast. Going to the dunes usually means a day at the beach, but the Indiana Dunes National Lakeshore, which spans 15 miles of Lake Michigan's coastline, is more than sand and waves. Kathy Martin of the nonprofit Save the Dunes says trails wind through a variety of habitats.
If you were to start at the lake, you would walk through to the beach, a foredune, a forested dune, oak savanna habitats, wetlands, and then woodlands.
Oak savannas, once common in the Midwest, are rapidly disappearing.
We have some really high-quality ones here left, so we'd like to say we have the best of the last of some things.
Making the dunes not just a beach, but a biological gem. Current Cast is produced in partnership with Cornell's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future. Learn more online at currentcast.org.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lazowitz, and this is Climate Connections.
There's a huge taboo around saying how important climate change is and saying what our fears are and what our hopes are.
That's Josephine Farrelly, co-founder of Conceivable Future. The organization sponsors house parties where people talk about how climate change influences their thoughts about family and having children.
We've had people testify about how much they're fighting for their own children. They testify sometimes about how they're undecided about whether or not to have children because of climate, or maybe they've decided not to have children. These are heartfelt statements about the importance of climate in our lives.
Farrelly says talking about the issues empowers participants to take climate action. She also wants decision makers to hear these stories, so she encourages people to submit their thoughts on the Conceivable Future website.
We're trying to put them in front of viewers who need to hear these stories. So that's decision makers, that's our community members, people who need to hear that climate is a huge concern for their constituents.
By centering the conversation on family, Conceivable Future provides a new and personal perspective on climate change.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
Hi, everybody. This is Natural Lee. I'm back with your upcoming events. We have three on March 25th, but I know you can make all three if you time it right. At 10 a.m. on this Saturday, you can join a guided hike through Swope Park and enjoy the budding trees and flowers in Kansas City's largest park. A Missouri Master Naturalist will lead the hike that begins at a trailhead near the Lakeside Nature Center. The hike is free and open to the public. There will be early out opportunities for those that wish to complete the hike before noon. Organizers suggest hikers dress appropriately for the weather, and carrying water is also recommended. Severe weather is considered a notice of cancellation. These hikes are not appropriate for children and strollers, as there are rocks and logs to step over and hills and valleys to traverse. It begins at 10 a.m. Saturday, March 25th at Lakeside Nature Center, which is located at 4701 East Gregory Boulevard. You can visit Lakeside Nature Center online for more information. After you do that guided hike through Swope Park, you can head on over to the Eat Local and Organic Expo. Snatch up early seedlings, fresh greens, free-range meats, and eggs, and meet local farmers at the 19th annual Kansas City Food Circle's Eat Local and Organic Expo on Saturday, March 25th. Starting at 10 a.m., the expo will include 15-minute How to Eat Local and Organic workshops that will be held every hour. Participants will receive a directory of local and organic farmers and free-range producers. This expo is free and will be held from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m., on Saturday, March 25th at Johnson County Community College Gym, which is located at 12345 College Boulevard in Overland Park, Kansas. And then that same Saturday, March 25th from 8:30 p.m. to 9:30 p.m., you can join millions of people around the world who will be turning off their lights for Earth Hour, a World Wildlife Fund action of solidarity in the fight against climate change. Now in its 11th year, World Wildlife Fund organizers ask participants to turn off all of their lights from 8:30 to 9:30 p.m. local time on Saturday, March 25th. The initiative represents participants' commitment to protecting the planet in support of the Paris Climate Agreement. And on April 1st, from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m., you can place orders. Well, I guess right now, up until the 15th, you can place orders for native tree and shrub seedlings from the Missouri Department of Conservation. Residents can choose from a wide variety of trees and shrubs and receive the seedlings in spring. This spring, MDC will offer behind-the-scenes public tours that showcase how the nursery grows, stores, and ships almost 3 million seedlings each year. The open house is scheduled for Saturday, April 1st from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. And you can reserve a spot by visiting them on the web at mdc.mo.gov. The MDC George O. White State Nursery offers one-year-old bare root seedlings with sizes varying by species. Tree and shrub seedling varieties include pine, pecan, oak, dogwood, tulip poplar, cottonwood, sweet gum, cypress, birch, and on and on and on, including serviceberry, mulberry, elderberry, and others. The seedling order form catalog displays a full listing and order form. Native trees, shrubs, and woody vines can help improve wildlife habitat, soil, and water conservation while also improving the appearance and value of property. Native plants can also be used for reforestation, windbreaks, erosion control, wildlife food, and cover. Seedlings are available in quantities of 10, 25, or 100 per species, and orders can be placed from now until April 15th. And visit them online to download the seedling order form catalog at mdc.mo.gov. And that's all for your events.
After 140 years, Indigenous people win a major victory. That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report about water. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin. And it's This Week in Water.
More people are using their asthma medications in Montana due to wildfires.
The tick season is lasting longer, making Lyme disease more of a worry on the East Coast.
And more violent storms and extreme weather events are causing severe damage, like that in Baton Rouge, Louisiana last year, where 13 people died during extreme flooding.
These problems, along with others, have led a large organization of doctors to issue a report about health problems caused by climate change.
The physicians are members of the Medical Society Consortium on Climate and Health, and they're warning that Americans need to become aware of medical problems associated with global warming.
The organization represents more than half of the physicians in the U.S. and have reached the point where they find it necessary to inform the public.
Even if we are not aware of all the medical issues associated with climate change, a new Gallup poll shows that the public views of the problem are changing.
45% of Americans now say they worry a great deal about global warming. That's the highest it's been in nearly three decades.
The poll also showed that almost 70% believe humans are causing the climate to change, and more than 60% are convinced we're already experiencing its negative effects.
While some in the Trump administration and the Republican-led Congress will not admit or recognize the problem, the new Secretary of Defense, James Mattis, sees it differently.
He stated recently that climate change is real and a threat to American interests abroad.
ProPublica reports that Mattis has long espoused the position that the armed forces, for a host of reasons, need to cut dependence on fossil fuels and explore renewable energy where it makes sense.
In Peru, about 70 people have been killed, and the number of homeless has increased since the deadliest rains in decades have hit the country's coast.
Nearly half of Peru has been affected, and the storms are expected to continue for another 2 weeks.
More than 800 cities have declared an emergency, and the capital, Lima, has been without water for days.
The health ministry has started fumigating around pools of water in streets to kill mosquitoes that carry diseases like dengue.
The BBC reports that Peru and other countries around the Pacific Ocean have been affected in recent months by the phenomenon known as El Niño, a rise in sea temperatures that increases evaporation and brings about heavy rains.
The Whanganui River in New Zealand is very important to the Maori people as a source of spiritual sustenance. They see it as a caregiver and a guardian.
It's the nation's third longest river, and last week it was given legal status, just like a human.
The New Zealand Herald reports that the river now has all the rights, duties, and liabilities that come with personhood.
Among other things, the river will now be represented in court proceedings, where one person from the Maori tribes and one from the government will speak for it.
An official said he knows some will think it strange to give a natural resource a legal personality, but it's no different than giving legal rights to a family trust, company, or corporation.
The Maori have been struggling for about 140 years to protect their river legally. When the law was passed, hundreds of tribal representatives wept with joy.
The people who live along the Whanganui have a well-known proverb that says, "I am the river is me."
The things we wear for comfort and exercise may be polluting the oceans, according to a new study.
The two-year inquiry led by the Mississippi-Alabama Sea Grant Consortium found that tiny little plastic fibers from things like yoga pants or fleece jackets and anything that's nylon or polyester shed microscopic pieces of plastic when they're washed, and those tiny pieces find their way into fish, oysters, and other wildlife.
And a new follow-up study is being launched along the Gulf Coast to see just how prevalent the problem is.
The Associated Press reports that experts are suggesting that manufacturers of washing machines may need to be encouraged to include filters that reduce plastic waste.
A study conducted by volunteers in Florida showed that nearly 90% of the samples included at least one piece of plastic, and among those, the smaller microfibers made up more than 80%.
One clothing company, Patagonia, is supporting research into microfiber pollution and is informing consumers about ways to minimize the effects, such as laundering clothes less often and using a front-loading washing machine. And finally, there was cake, there were balloons and streamers, everything you'd expect at a birthday party.
Everything except that the guest of honor at this celebration was a hole, a 15 by 20 foot sinkhole to be exact, that opened up east of San Francisco.
Locals gathered at a busy intersection in the suburb of Moraga to sing happy birthday and joke, but they also wanted to call attention to the fact that the massive crater hadn't been fixed for over a year.
Last March, a series of El Niño-linked storms saturated the ground at the intersection, causing the collapse. But 1 year later, the town says it doesn't have the $3.3 million needed for repairs, so it's been left to jump through federal hoops to get the funds.
Sinkholes can occur for various reasons. Natural sinkholes can result over time from water seeping into the ground and eroding soil and rock. They can also be the result of drilling, mining, or even heavy traffic. Most often they form from broken water or drain pipes.
A spokesperson for Public Works said they've nearly completed the required paperwork and expect repairs to begin sometime this summer.
As for the partygoers, their patience is running thin. Waiting another 4 more months for Washington to send the money? That leaves them fed up with the whole business. This Week in Water is supported by the American Water Works Association. Build a better world through better water at AWWA's ACE 17 in Philadelphia, June 11th through 14th. Learn more at awwa.org/ACE17.
Thanks for listening. host Eco Radio KC on 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.